Welcome to the Sullivan Strumpf podcast. I'm Ursula Sullivan. This week, we're really excited to introduce the new show by Sam Leach titled Fully Automatic. To do this, we're having an interview with Andrew Frost, who is a critic, lecturer and broadcaster, and of course, Sam Leach. Sam was born in Adelaide and he's the only artist we represent with an economics degree. An unusual start for an artist, but the degree gave him an insight into the concept of science, economics as a science, and therefore all research as science, and the way that we use the research, the information, and how we interpret that information aesthetically, how it's illustrated aesthetically. In his 2016 PhD paper, which he did at RMIT, he says art has an important role to play in providing a critical reception for science and in considering the way scientific findings affect us emotionally. Understanding that complex relationship is the key to his practice. So without further ado, and with all of that in mind, let's have a listen to how his ideas have progressed and developed since then. Enjoy.
Having known your work for a while, looking at the new pictures, there's an undeniable sense of connection between these works and the works that you've done in the past, but there's also something very creepy about these images, something very uncanny that really stands out on first viewing. Mm-hmm. Could you talk a little bit about how this body of work came into being and what was the process that we were using in putting it together?
So the work is composed using an algorithm and then painted by me. And what the algorithm is doing is what's known as a generative adversarial network. It's a neural network-based algorithm. And basically what it's doing is I'm giving it a database of images that it's looking at, and then it's trying to generate a new image. And there's two parts. There's a part that's generating this image and a part that's discriminating. It's discriminating against whether the image that's being generated is part of the data set or not. And it goes through cycles. So each time it goes through a cycle, it gets a little bit better at generating an image and a little bit better at telling whether that image is part of the data set or something that's generated.
My understanding of that is that you have input images of your previous work into the computer. It then sorts through the noise to find patterns in the images that match in some way images that you've produced in the past. Is that right?
Yeah, essentially that's right. I mean, it's convolutional. So what it's doing is kind of taking the images and breaking them down into smaller segments and then looking for patterns within those segments. So, for example, when I'm putting in my previous work, where I've got work that has a very strong graphic element, you know, like an abstract circle or a stripe or something, that's very easy for the algorithm to identify through that process and then replicate. So those types of images tend to, you know, dominate in what's being produced. So I can manipulate a little bit what's being produced by controlling that input data set. But yeah, it's what I'm putting in there is my own previous paintings, images that I'm interested in and want to bring out in the work, you know, archives of images that I've kind of used to generate my previous works, early landscapes, images from NASA, images from scientific laboratories, robotics, all these topics that I've always kind of drawn on for my source imagery. But now instead of me doing the hard labor of combining and finding the connections, I can just get the computer to spit out the answer for me.
Is the process generating a new way of looking at the same material?
I think it is generating new ways of looking at things. So when I look at those paintings, of course, it's still the kind of painting that I do because I'm drawn clearly to certain things and those are the things that I'm putting into the algorithm. But it's drawing out new aspects of this source material that I wouldn't have previously looked at, or new ways of bringing things together. And that then shapes and influences what I program into the next round of images that I'm getting it to produce. So I think it's taking things in different directions.
You can kind of make out that there are elements within the output from the program that suggest things, but obviously there's another layer of interpretation that you're making on the output to decide how these things go together and what the kind of elements of the pictures are. Can you talk through some of the decision-making process you have? I mean, is it intuitive? Is there another process on top of this?
This is, I guess, the ironic element of this in that having set out to minimize the amount of cognitive labor I need to do to produce a work, it's actually presenting me with even more problems than I had before. So when I'm looking at those blurry images, they're suggestive to me. There's elements in there where, because I've programmed the database, I know the images that it's, if you like, reaching for. And so sometimes I bring them out, and sometimes it's more suggestive and intuitive. And, you know, I just think, well, that looks like a piece of hair, or it looks like a reclining body in that position. And so it can be fun to try and draw those elements out. Previously, a lot of my effort went into selecting the source imagery I was going to use, combining it and, you know, making really quite a detailed preparatory image, and then transforming that into a painting. So, you know, there was a transposition process going from this image I usually design in Photoshop and then putting it onto the canvas. So I'm not doing really anything like as much work on that side of things. Instead, the majority of my work is now focused on the actual painting itself. So it's in the process of painting that I'm making a lot of these decisions, which is quite, you know, it's quite an enjoyable shift, actually. But yeah, it's much more decisions made as the painting is being produced.
I just want to focus a bit more on the inspiration to use this process. Were you looking at other artists who are using this kind of related processes?
Where it actually started was a project I did about 3 years ago with a neuroscientist looking at how bees and birds visually navigate the world. So he was looking at, you know, their visual cognition systems, the way that they navigate, and then using that research to build biomimetic drones that navigate the world in the same way. And he was showing me the visualization, if you like, of how the computer was replicating that vision of the birds and the bees. And I was quite interested in how this computer vision, you could sort of see the connection with, I guess, animal vision, but it was also its own language. So it looked sort of strange and disconcerting to see what the computer was relying on for navigation. So then I kind of went down a little bit of a process of looking at different aspects of computer vision and came across this research into using machine learning to generate images.
What's kind of interesting, and I guess it sort of relates to your work in this way, is that the closer it gets, these projects get to producing a work of art that can simulate a sense of authenticity in the artwork, still has this sense of the uncanny, of the inhuman, the unheimlich within the work. And this seems very, very resonant with what you're doing. I mean, do you have a sense of the viewer response to this work? Because, I mean, clearly you must be experiencing it yourself as well.
What we're seeing coming out of it is kind of strange and unexpected. And I think as that gets refined, yeah, we're getting towards that uncanny valley territory. And I enjoy that aspect of it, because that's kind of a pleasing place to be. You're creating something unstable in the artwork. And like, I've been listening to a bit of AI generated music as well. Similarly, you know, there's some of that stuff that borders on the unlistenable. But then there's some that you do get into a really strange territory. So, you know, you're hearing voices singing in a particular way. Sometimes it almost sounds like language, and then it turns into something a little bit different. And it's like a strange experience. I wouldn't necessarily say that it's a musically thrilling experience all the time. You know, there's something about the emotional connection that rarely hits. But there's something really fascinating about it.
When the programs that are used in various ways to produce work similar to what you're doing, not the same obviously, but similar, and I think there's an element of this in these pictures that you've made, is that there's a potential to forget that the whole process has been put in train by a human, that the programming and the software was something that was produced by a human, and it has human-like outputs. So we recognize things that we know. So when I look at your work, this series of works, I see things in it that might accord with how you would describe it in art terms. Kind of, I think this series of works has a much more pronounced surreal element to it, surrealistic element to it than perhaps your work has had in the past. Your work, I think, has avoided being surrealist in the sense of the subjects that you've used as well as the kind of painting references within the work. But this process, even though it is human generated in one sense, it also has produced, as you say, something quite eerie, something unaccountable in this combination of subjects, of forms, the way things flow together, the way a bird's head is part of a machine, the way the foreground is part of the background, a kind of disruption of images. It leaves you with a very keen sense of the space in the work. And as you say, it's quite unnerving.
Yeah, the algorithm, in a sense, is quite a democratic viewer. You know, it doesn't have any preconception about what part of an image should be valued over any other part of an image. So that's, I think, part of why it's coming up with different solutions or different suggestions. But the surrealism thing, I think, is it's an interesting connection because as I do these works, I feel like there's an aspect of it that's like, you know, the automatic writing or the automatic drawing type of processes. So, you know, trying to somehow find a way to circumvent, if you like, the, you know, the rational conscious decisions that artist makes about, you know, what their subject matter is and tap into something deeper or alternative. In this case, what it's tapping into is not so much my unconscious as, I guess, a form of probability, a form of mathematics.
That's a very interesting suggestion because it kind of in turn suggests that there's a kind of reality that we have not perceived because our cultural affinities, if you like, with art history, with art historical language, with the way in which humans put images together is in one sense a limiting factor to the way in which we could experience an aesthetic beyond ourselves, if you like. It's something that we haven't experienced before. And that leads me to another point about this work is because of this process that you're using, it has a very profound sense of newness about it. It feels so very much of the moment or uncharted territory.
Yeah, I think that's part of it. And since I've started doing this work, the field of artificial intelligence or machine learning has progressed significantly. So I've been working with this algorithm now for 2.5 years. This is really the first full show I've made using this process. But in that time, it's come ahead in leaps and bounds. I mean, it's a field that is really ripe for, I guess, critical analysis because it's very quickly going into many aspects of our society. So, you know, of course, to me, what's interesting is landscape and science and technology images, but I find the iconography, I guess, fascinating in those things because it tells us something about our culture. So I think in a way, the algorithm has a potential to expose those elements in as much as those elements are also a problem for the application of the technology. You can almost imagine machine learning becoming ubiquitous to the extent that cultural production, if you like, ceases at a certain time. It's like a singularity of cultural production. And then all we're left with is endless recombinations of this material that's already been produced. As a painter, you know, I know that art history has always had this process where it's constantly feeding on itself. Artists are always referring back to the work that's come before them, combining those things in new ways and you know, incrementally moving forwards. Occasionally, there's someone who produces something totally new and that's a surprise, but then that gets folded in as well. So, you know, it's like occasionally there's this new input into the database and the rest of the time we're all just churning away, taking elements from this history and recombining it and representing it. So, you know, I think the algorithm, if you like, extends, maybe accelerates that process.
I think there's always that possibility. I was just thinking of a short story by J.G. Ballard about a group of writers and poets living in a place called Vermilion Sands, which is a kind of an artist commune of the future. And the writers and the poets are using computers to generate their novels and poems with very little input from them. And into this story comes a woman who's sort of outrageously writing her own stuff. She's not using computers. And there's this, the conclusion of the story, as I can remember it, is that, you know, there's this sort of disruption of this very kind of almost Rococo aesthetic around the writing of these computer-generated works of art, returning to something resembling authenticity in the artist's relationship to their materials and the work that they're doing. And I think that has some resonance in your work because you've taken that step to interpret yourself and to do the painting yourself. And so it sort of sits in a very interesting conceptual space between, on the one hand, the kind of conceptually pure, if you like, approach of saying, well, the AI does the work itself, the program does the work itself, and that's it, and this is the output. But you've taken a different direction. You've chosen to reinstate the artist's hand into the process. I mean, how critical do you think that is in relationship to what we were just talking about? Do you think that retains a sense of authenticity in the project?
Yeah, by definition, it does. I mean, it's an authentic artwork that's produced by human, and it's human decisions that have created it from like the very beginning of the process to the very end. Although there is a lot of processing that goes into those decisions in the intermediary stage, so a lot of technological processing of the decisions. But I think of the machine learning process as a tool, you know, really a tool in the kit that painters use, and a tool that's going to be used in a critical way as they always are. So it's not just that it's a way to make painting easier, although hopefully it is also that. It's also that idea of art that, you know, you're always using the material to produce the work, also to ask questions about the material itself. And so in the same way, you use this tool to make the work, and at the same time as you're asking questions about the tool.
Yeah, I mean, that prompts me for my next thought is, why would an artist paint in oils now in the 2020s?
You know, it's a means of self-expression. But it also has that continuity with history, that it's a language that's evolved. It's an understandable system that over time has been used to portray and critique all manners of cultural production. The other reason that I started going down this path was Aaron Bastani's Fully Automatic Luxury Communism. Basically, it's a suggestion that, or a proposal if for a society that is post-scarcity and post-work, and you would use expert systems, machine learning, artificial intelligence, 3D printers, robotics, all that sort of stuff to basically minimize the amount of labor that any human has to do. And then it's just caviar and infinity pools for everybody. And it was just great to read work, you know, especially a socialist or a communist work that was, you know, a kind of technological utopian vision. And to actually see a proposal for that being implemented that is not corporately driven. Yeah, I'd rather be in, you know, E&M Bank's world than Robocop world. That's really where I want to be.
Yeah, well, I mean, the thing is that when you talk about E&M Bank's and the culture, it's like, you know, you're talking about a future in which the culture is post-scarcity, post-work and everything, but there's also kind of moral lethargy going on, that there needs to be conflict or something to sort of jazz up the everyday experience, because lots of other science fiction often talks about, you know, the future as being on the one hand utopian in the sense that every need is catered for, but dystopian in the sense that there's a very much ingrained belief that labor is dignity, that there's liberation in working for your bread, you know.
Yeah, I am on board with the idea that there is dignity in labor and even a joy in labor, because that's why I'm still doing the paintings. Otherwise, I would just be hitting print on and putting up the digital works. I still enjoy the process of actually working on something. Rejoinder, I guess, to that would be that you have a model for that society, and it's the aristocracy in the 17th and 18th century. And, you know, they didn't have any problem basically passing the time. It was, they were fine. And
no, well, look, if it involves powdered wigs, I'm in.
Yeah, exactly. That's why there's all the, you know, the Fragonard kind of elements in these works. And that's where that's going.
That's interesting. I didn't realise. I was thinking about the sort of arbitrary hierarchy that people apply to materials, that sculptures are only important if they're made of marble, or if they're made of, you know, stone or something, and that paintings are only really important if they're painted in oils. And so, you know, there is that dialogue between the painting process in oils and the way in which these images are made, which speaks very much of this moment, in the same way that the analog synth music of the 70s and early 80s, you know, has its own sound. It has a sort of its own texture, which related to the technology that produced it, of what that could be done at the time. You know, so you have a combination of, on the one hand, a Moog synth and then a real drum kit, you know. So there's that sort of dialogue between synthesis and analog that has a great resonance, I think, in what you're doing.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, there's an element that painting for some time has been, you know, perversely anachronistic, you know, and that's kind of part of the joy of it, you know, really. There's a quality when you confront a painting that, you know, it's difficult to express it because it's a visceral reaction you have to, you know, to that particular medium. Well, I should say it's a visceral reaction I have to that particular medium. I can't speak for everyone, but it's like all of those things, you know, you have to believe in it for it to actually work. So I choose to believe in that.
Of course, there has to be some suspension of disbelief there because otherwise, you know, art would not exist. Is that a communal belief that the sort of symbolic language means something to not just the artist and maybe one viewer, but to everyone in some way? And that's why it seems to me, you know, what I was saying before about how this work really says to me that it has a sense of newness. What I mean is that the present moment is the thing that feels most like the future to us because it is a forming thing. It is something that is being produced around us. And when we have monumental worldwide events like COVID or, you know, the war on terror or any of those transformative moments, I guess the kind of aesthetic expression of the moment that has some sense of the zeitgeist is really bracing because it presents us with something that in some ways is very recognizable, but in other ways has elements of things that just seem strange and a bit scary. When you alter or change the parameters of that relationship with that perceived and understood history and knowledge is when you really start to mess around with people because you're cutting them adrift from the ability to successfully associate a lifetime of learned responses into something like an AI-generated image or an AI-assisted image that is not normally there.
Part of that is unsettling. I think part of it is also enjoyable in the sense that when it works, it creates a sense of weightlessness, I think. You feel suddenly like these things have become, you know, detached and unmoored in a certain way. And I quite enjoy that feeling that maybe you can make a painting that is, in a way, perfectly weightless. When I'm making work, you know, there's a whole lot of symbolism and history some of it is consciously alluded to in the work. Some of it emerges through the process of combining things. But with this process, all of that type of decision-making is further away from the image that gets presented. And in some ways so far away that it no longer really affects what's actually being seen. And I quite enjoy that feeling. I quite enjoy that feeling of being unmoored.
Yeah, me too.
You can find out more about Sam Leach and all of our artists by checking out the website www.sullivanstrumpf.com. And if you'd like to hear more podcasts, check out Buzzsprout, Spotify, Apple, all the places where you get your podcasts.